All right, everyone, welcome back. Today we're going to be getting to the end of the journey. We're going to reach the present day, because what we're dealing with today is the period from 1700 to the present, so the modern English period. Just a quick note before we start. The exam is in 2 weeks' time, and you have 90 minutes for the exam. That means that we're going to start at 10 o'clock. That means you will need to be here and sitting down by 10 o'clock so that you can get your exam script so that we can start in time. If you come in later than 10 o'clock, I cannot guarantee that I will let you start the exam in the first place, because that's just how mean I am. Okay? So be here and be ready to start the exam at 10. You will need to bring your student ID card, and we'll check those during the course of the exam. So this is the last time I introduce any new content on the course. Next week we're going to be doing revision, and the week after that is the exam itself. So next week what we cover will be just an overview of some of the core topics, some of the take-home messages, and that kind of thing, just to give you a refresher and to help you see the bigger picture. Because we've done different things on this course. We've delved quite deeply into particular texts. We've also talked in quite a global way about the whole history of the language, and you need to be able to think in both of these kinds of ways in order to be a good educated human being, but more importantly for your present purposes to do well on the exam. So here we go with modern English, and we're going to, like I say, bring ourselves up to the present day in today's lecture. And we're going to cover the usual linguistic areas. Again, in the modern period, spelling and sound, we're going to consider them together, not because they are the same thing, because they're definitely not, but because they have a relation to each other that is more difficult to disentangle at this period. We'll talk about the morphology, the syntax, the lexicon, and then we'll end up by talking about different varieties of English that emerge during this period, and attitudes to the English language that also emerge during this period. All right, so what's going on during this period, 1700 to present? Well, we had the Renaissance last time. In the West, the 18th century is often called the Age of Reason. This is the time of the intellectual movement called the Enlightenment, which has at its basis the idea that we should be returning to or turning to science and to reason to guide our thinking, rather than just simply relying on established wisdom. While the Renaissance was more about bringing back the wisdom of the ancients from ancient Greece and ancient Rome, the Enlightenment was more about discovering things for yourselves, using the empirical methods of science, using the faculties of reason that we as human beings possess. So we have this Enlightenment era. And at the same time, relatedly, we have certain social changes and political changes. One of the most important is American independence. That's an event, it's hard to state how much it shaped the world today, America being independent. We also get the French Revolution shortly afterwards, which is usually seen as a much less pleasant, more bloody affair, but the two movements have an awful lot in common in terms of their reliance, their desire to return power to the people, essentially. We also get the abolition of the slave trade in Britain in 1807 during this period, which ultimately stems from the same aims, the same goals. And in the United States, this took a lot longer to come to fruition, and therefore slavery was a part of everyday life in some parts of the states up until the 20th century. So that's a big difference between our enlightened transatlantic brothers and us Brits, though I'm not claiming the moral high ground. I would have very, very little ground to do so, especially right now. It's a race to the bottom, really, but never mind. 19th century, Romanticism. We have the Industrial Revolution as well. So Romanticism is a philosophical movement, it's a literary movement. It focuses on the ideas that emotional experience is very, very important as a reaction to Enlightenment, which is much more reason-based, You get this dichotomy being set up, the reason-emotion dichotomy. You have nationalism rising during this period related to Romanticism. Romanticism romanticizes things, so a lot of the thought about, actually the thought about languages stems from this period. The idea that languages are in some sort of terrible state of decay. This is something that you don't often hear in the UK context so much, but in Germany you often people say, oh, Sprachverfall, Sprachverfall, as if someone was just going to come with a bulldozer and knock down your language. And this is bollocks. I can put it quite bluntly, but it stems from, more importantly, it stems from Enlightenment thought. It stems from this idea that there was this beautiful primeval language that was kind of perfect, and ever since then things have really been going downhill somewhat. We also get, so the Romanticism is a reaction to the Enlightenment, also to the Industrial Revolution, which is very much the gritty reality of the time. So during the Industrial Revolution, we get a mass move away from agricultural lifestyles towards urban lifestyles. People move to the cities. They move to different kinds of jobs. They lose one kind of independence and gain another kind. Wage slaves is often the term that is used. So the cities grow, and cities become essentially the center of the universe during this period. And obviously, this is an industrial revolution, so machines and factories take center stage. As for the 20th century, some of you were there. I was. Some of you, is anyone here born 2000 or later? I hope not. God, I feel really old now. Okay. The 20th century, which is soon to be ancient history, had lots of wars in it, lots of technological advancements as well, moved towards a post-industrial society, a post-manufacturing society, and those processes have, of course, left their mark very clearly on the world that we live in today. So how does this affect the language? Well, we will see. In terms of writers during this period, there are far too many to name. Just some of the big names are listed on this slide, and this is really only a very partial overview of what's happening during this period. So there are British writers here, there are American writers here, lots of people using the English language as their medium, and this correlates with the rise of English as a global language, which is something that we'll also discuss later on today. So the 18th century authors that we mention here are mostly British authors. So we have scientists like Isaac Newton, but we also, in America, we have people like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, a famous political writer. We also get women writers who have prominence in their own right as authors during this period. Perhaps for the first time in the history of the language. So Jane Austen, still very widely read today, Pride and Prejudice, etc. And Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein. There's all kinds going on during the 18th century. During the 19th century, this continues. So some major intellectual figures such as Charles Darwin, but also all kinds of authors, Mark Twain, Robert Louis Stevenson, both sides of the Atlantic again. And during the 20th century, again, these names will mostly be familiar to you, I'd imagine. And the result of this is, when you think about how much difficulty we had drawing any kind of meaningful conclusions about the Old English and even early Middle English, based on the texts that we had, it's really quite striking now that when we look at modern English, we do not lack for sources. Of course, we don't have sources for everything, but we certainly have a lot more than we previously did, because these people who we have listed on the slide are not only monks, as they were in the Old English period, they represent all genders, all classes, pretty much all races, insofar as that term even means anything. So we have a huge cross-section of society, and when we look at the modern English language, we can examine it in much more depth. We can get a lot more empirical rigor in what we know about this language. Okay, so moving on now to the sounds and the spelling of the language. I've already told you that in the early modern period, the alphabet that we have is basically the same as it is today, and obviously then that doesn't change. So we have, by 1700, Modern English spelling is already mostly fixed, so we don't really see any changes after this period. There are a few things that sort of are dying off during this period that we still see. So we see lots of nouns being capitalized seemingly randomly, especially during this early period. It's not entirely random, but nor is it as systematic as we see in, say, modern German, in the standard language. So extra capitalization is one of the odd points. But by 1850, standardization is complete, and that means that insofar as we have variation, we only see variant spellings. So we see variant spellings, across from, for instance, American English and British English. The classic examples of these are O-U-R in words like labor and color. That is the British spelling, whereas the O-R without the U is the American spelling. Eyes with a Z versus eyes with an S. This is not something that... This is often said to be an American versus British spelling difference. It's actually not quite as simple as that. So it's true that eyes with a Z is basically the only variant that you find in the States. But the eyes with a Z and the eyes with an S are basically variants that British people will use fairly interchangeably. Some people have a preference for one, some people have a preference for others, some people with certain words. So it's not as simple as just saying that eyes with an S is the British variant. But that, I guess, is the broad outline of the difference. Here, Webster's Dictionary, which is the first dictionary to attempt to put the American standard language on the same footing as the British standard language, and not to see the American language as simply an offshoot of, or a sort of a debased version of British English, this plays a crucial role in codifying some of these differences. If you remember the four processes of standardization that we saw last time, Haugen's processes of standardization, so selection, codification, elaboration and acceptance. This dictionary is an important part of codification in the context of America. Now, people have sometimes tried to reform the spelling of English, but they've typically not been successful. The last time there was a serious attempt to do this was by an MP for the British Labour Party, Mont Follock. And in 1949, he brought a bill to the British Parliament to reform the spelling of the language. And what he was proposing is what you can see up there. We instinctively shrink from any change in what is familiar. And what can be more familiar than the form of words that we have seen and written more times than we can possibly estimate? Now, if Mont Follock had been successful, if his bill had passed through the British Parliament, maybe we'd all be writing like this now. The fact is, he wasn't successful, and there has never been a successful movement to officially reform English, British English spelling, or indeed American English spelling. And nowadays, there would be so many practical difficulties in doing so that I think it's probably inconceivable that anything like this will happen. There are, as I'm sure you're aware, good reasons to think about doing something like this, because the mapping between phonology and orthography in English is quite frankly horrendous. And this is something that we touched upon in the first lecture. Because of the great vowel shift and other changes that have taken place after the standardization of spelling, our spelling system is basically a bit of a mess. Okay, so that's spelling per se. As far as pronunciation is concerned, there aren't any more major sound changes to discuss for this period. The sound changes, the sound variants that you'll encounter, we've already come across, pretty much. We'll talk about a few more later when we talk about regional variation. But what does become important during this period is correct pronunciation. So again, even now, we're talking a lot about attitudes to the language. We're not just talking about how the language itself is changing. We're talking about how people view the language and how people think about how it ought to be spoken. So there was quite a lot of tolerance before the 18th century. We've talked about the emergence of dictionaries, lists of homophones, and things like that. We get in 1775 Spence's Grand Repository of the English Language. People like giving their dictionaries really fancy names during this period. We'll see some more later on. But in the Grand Repository, you see not only, this isn't special because it's the first dictionary, there were dictionaries before this, but this one was special because it had the pronunciation listed in the dictionary for the word. So it has a kind of pseudo-phonetic transcription within parentheses after the head word. So this is useful, obviously, for learners of the language, and not only for learners, foreign learners of the language, because they were not considered important enough to write books for. This is more for people who were trying to improve their station in life within the British system, let's say. So if you're trying to get in with the posh crowd, you need to talk like the posh people, and that's what a dictionary like this would enable you to do. And in fact, this preoccupation with sounding like the upper classes became so much of a big deal during this period that there are essentially stories written about it. George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion is the classic case. You might be familiar with the musical version of this story, My Fair Lady. It's the same story. There's a professor of phonetics, Henry Higgins, one of the few linguists in fiction, and he trains a girl who is a Cockney, that is a London local working class girl called Eliza Doolittle. He trains her to speak standard English. And this is he's sort of boasting about how he can convert her into a speaker of the standard language. And this is exactly what he starts doing. And I won't spoil the story for you, because it's a good story, but obviously it's not quite as simple as she learns standard English and they all lived happily ever after. Shaw himself was actually Irish, and this might be one of the reasons that he was so aware of how the English language made people think of each other. He says, "It's impossible for an Englishman to open his mouth without making some other Englishman despise him." I think this is largely true. The particular variable that he picks up on, that Shaw picks up on, is the pronunciation of the initial H, so H dropping. We've already seen, and you might remember, that words like the pronunciation of initial H is already lost in consonant clusters. So, for instance, so the word laughter is in the Old English text, you find chlechtor with an H, and this H was dropped. So this H dropping is something that starts early, it starts in the Middle English period, and in some varieties of English it was completely generalized so that all H's in initial position were dropped. And here you get, in the variety that is that the Cockneys would have spoken, often gets called something like estuary English because it's spoken around the Thames estuary in Essex and in London. In this variety, dropping of the H is completely normal. So one of the things that Eliza Doolittle has to do is pronounce this sentence with the H's in initial position. In Hampshire, Hereford and Hartford, hurricanes hardly ever happen. And of course, the natural tendency here is to drop the H. So in Hampshire, Hereford and Hartford, hurricanes hardly ever happen. So you get a glottal stop there instead. Now, when Eliza Doolittle is learning to do this, what she does is she overpronounces the H. So she would say at the end here for something like, hurricanes hardly ever happen. Right. So just put an H in just to be on the safe side on the front of every word that has a vowel at the beginning. So this is a form of hypercorrection. But this is just to illustrate that correct pronunciation at this point was really a big deal. And this goes hand in hand with, I think, not only the establishment of a British class system, because to a certain extent there had always been a class system, but actually what you also see during this period is greater social mobility. So during the Industrial Revolution, you get certain commoners, such as a man called Richard Arkwright, who develops the spinning jenny, which is used in cotton mills. He becomes tremendously wealthy, wealthier than most of the hereditary nobility. And what that means, broadly speaking, is that it becomes possible for people to rise up and to sink down in the social hierarchy. Same in America. You've got this American dream. Social hierarchies are no longer fixed kind of feudal entities. They are mobile, and that means that when language is an important indicator of class, you've got a big incentive to speak a certain way in order to not be judged, or rather to be judged, but to be judged positively rather than negatively. There are still many regional pronunciations of English. During the 19th and 20th centuries, regional variants lose some of these distinctive features as a consequence of population movement and urbanization, and they gain others, actually, it's worth saying. So certain varieties, such as Geordie, spoken in Newcastle, and Mancunian varieties, spoken in Manchester, and also Liverpudlian in Liverpool, these urban varieties are perhaps the most famous of the British English accents now. But the traditional rural varieties, on the other hand, have seen a concomitant decrease. So here's some variables. In the north, you get people retaining the ch in words like night. So they would say nicht or something like that. So this is not actually a stigmatized variant in this variety. You also see a retention of the U vowel in a word like cow. So for me, it's cow. For a true northerner, it would be ku, right? Which again, may be reminiscent of something. You also get hus, and these variants, these are very much northern variants. You hear these in their greatest purity these days in varieties of Scots and Scottish English. But they're around in other places too. In the south, you've got this initial fricative voicing. We've already seen this as a major feature of southern texts from the Middle English period onwards. So they'll take the fricative at the beginning of a word like further and see, and they'll pronounce it as verther and z. Exaggerating a bit there, but you get the idea. And as we saw last time, Shakespeare uses this for comic effect when he's portraying rustic rural people. You also get an A-like pronunciation for certain words in northern varieties. So ham for home and twa for two. Again, the further north you go, the more likely you are to hear this. And in most of the regional varieties where it used to have been spoken, for instance, where I come from in the county of Derbyshire, you wouldn't hear this really at all anymore, though you might have done during the 19th and early 20th centuries. And if you want, you can go on the BBC website, and it gives you a little map. You can click around and play with listening to different British dialects, different British accents. So if you want to get an idea of what some of these things sound like from real speakers, that's very, very easy to do. One of the big sound changes that we've already discussed to some extent, and we're going to discuss more now, is what happens to post-vocalic R. So post-vocalic R, in the late 16th century, so before the period that we're talking about today, this post-vocalic R weakens and is lost. And it becomes lost in the late 16th century. It changes the quality of the preceding vowel and also the quantity. It usually makes that vowel somewhat further back and somewhat longer, this R. Now, this is something that becomes established in Britain. It becomes established in London. It becomes established in much of England, but never in Scotland. So Scotland doesn't do this R loss. But in British English, it's basically all over the place, certainly in the standard. In American English, there is variation. So before the settlers were moving to America, the new pronunciation, the pronunciation without R, was already widespread. So they took this with them, some of the settlers, but not all of them. Because the people who settled America were not just random English people, a lot of them were actually Irish or Scottish in origin. Or they were from places like the Southwest, which retained the R independently. In America, you have all kinds of interesting developments, and if you do some sociolinguistics, you will no doubt hear about William LeBove's classic study, where he goes into New York department stores And he gets people to pronounce the words fourth floor or fourth floor with an R on the end. And he manages to draw conclusions because you've got different department stores and the posher department stores do one thing and the less posh department stores do the other, which goes to show that how much you pronounce these word final R's as consonants is a social indicator in America of this period. So that's the status. So initially, as is often the case, the new variant is the less prestigious one. So at the start of this change, the version without R, so the version like I'm speaking now, is the less prestigious variant. Over time, that becomes the more prestigious variant because it's associated with London and it's also associated with the higher classes. The other interesting phenomenon that you get, and you might have heard about this already in the context of Xi Wan, is certain R's getting inserted where you otherwise might not expect them to be. So if we say the word that is given here before amp, if we say it on its own, it would be tuner. So tuner as something that a piano tuner, for instance, is indistinguishable from the fish. So a tuner, as in the fish you catch from the sea, is the same as a tuner that you have in one of these devices or something that fixes your piano. But here, in the context of a following vowel, so this is what linking R means. This R is pronounced. So you'd say something like tuner amp. You hear that hopefully? Not tuner amp, tuner amp. So the R becomes the onset of the following syllable. And this happens even in words that historically would never have had an R in them. So vowel final words, which have an R, which are before vowel initial words. So here we have law and order. And when you pronounce this, it will come out as something like law and order in my variety. Saw a film with a R. Saw a film. This is where British English actually overproduces R's. And this is completely standard. This is something that everyone does in standard British English. Similarly, if you say that this is a dessert with banana in it, it's banana R with a R. One of my linguistics colleagues in Cambridge, when I was studying there, used to always suggest that we go to Pizza Express because you insert the R, Pizza Express. So that's intrusive R. Intrusive R is the one that crops up where etymologically there was no R. Linking R is just the one that shows up when you have a word that historically would have ended in R, like tuna, this version of tuna. Well, if you want to improve your own English pronunciation in order to rise up in the ranks of the English upper classes, my services are available for a small fee. But otherwise, just learn about what they do in the history of the language. That's the important thing for the exam in 2 weeks' time. Okay, morphology. So something you've probably seen in English is that we have no case system left, basically. And this is something that from the Middle English period onwards is characteristic. So late Middle English has already lost its case system, except in pronouns. Pronouns retain case. But pronouns retain case sometimes, and that case is used in a way that doesn't really reflect, again, their historical origins, or indeed their synchronic function in terms of subject versus object. So traditionally, if you talk about first-person plural pronouns, what is the first-person plural pronoun in a subject? We, right? Simple as that. But not here. Here you've got a modified subject. This is in Dickens' novel Bleak House. So us London lawyers don't often get an out. So us London lawyers. This, interestingly, so people who are professionals, copy editors and pedants will sometimes correct this thing. But again, otherwise it's totally standard. There's nothing colloquial about doing this. And you can see this already from Dickens because these are lawyers, right? They're not low status people at all. Harriet in Jane Austen's Emma says, "For they are quite as well educated as me," which should prescriptively be an I should be quite as well educated as I, strictly speaking, simply because this is an elliptical utterance and this is the subject. So this means quite as well educated as I am. So this might be some kind of joke on the part of Jane Austen, but equally, it's likely enough that it just educates, that it just illustrates regular usage, just illustrates what people do from the 18th, 19th century onwards in English. This kind of use of the most common use of the pronoun here is where you use what was originally the accusative or dative version, so the object version, in subject position. And that's what we see in the two examples at the top. But you also see examples of the opposite. So here's two Shakespeare examples. In Merchant of Venice, we get, all debts are cleared between you and I. This I is the object form, but it's used in the complement of a preposition where we ought to expect it to be, if these were really, if these cases really represented grammatical relations, we'd expect this to be between you and me. Similarly, you've seen Othello and she together. Because this is an object, again, if this were an object pronoun, we'd expect it to be Othello and her. Because we don't see that, we can infer that the case system in modern English is not really a case system in the sense of representing grammatical functions anymore. Now, we can't dwell too deeply on the system behind this, but there is a system behind it. And the context here is that if you have pronouns that are part of the larger noun phrase, so particularly coordinated pronouns, if you get subjects without a following clause, then you get these unexpected forms. So it's perfectly grammatical to say something like, you have seen Othello and she together, but it's not grammatical to say you have seen she, or me have seen she, even though it's perfectly grammatical to say John and me have seen her. So these case forms start to get messed around during this period. Like I say, this is kind of, you might see it as the final demise of the English case system, but that would be a rather negative way of seeing it. What we're just seeing is a distribution of forms of the pronouns that is somewhat different from what we see in the earlier stages of the language, that's all. In terms of verbal agreement, there are various little changes that happen. Again, these relate to varieties, and very few of these changes are completely neutral, because these changes are still recent enough that they're judged. So, for instance, ain't, the word ain't as a construction for be and not, is something that we commonly find in the 18th century. So, I ain't coming, rather than I'm not coming, or I am not coming, he ain't coming. Actually, ain't is a great form because it's completely invariable. I ain't, he ain't, she ain't, they ain't, we ain't. It doesn't inflect, which means that it's a very practical form for language users to use. Nevertheless, it's heavily stigmatized. So this is something that's really not part of the standard language. It's something that you often see in fictional colloquial representations of the English language. When you're trying to indicate that the speaker is of a lower class or uneducated or something like that. So this is a very stigmatized form. It's commonly heard among the kind of people who say it. If you go to England, you'll run into it, for instance, or America. Because again, this is something that predates the settlement, or at least it predates some of the movement of peoples to the New World. Many varieties of English also regularize the verbal paradigm in terms of this S, because if you remember the verbal paradigms we saw last time, the S is basically the only thing left, the only verbal inflection that is left in the English language in the present tense. So we have this S, which indicates third person singular, and that's the standard. So I walk, you walk, but she, he, it walks. In East Anglia, you lose the S. So in East Anglian varieties, this is in the far east of England, the east and the south, you get the S dropping off entirely. This is also a development that is common to some varieties of American English. So African-American vernacular English loses the S as well. Now, in Northern and Southwestern dialects, they do the opposite. So a lot of these varieties generalize the S so completely that every form has the S on it. So you get I walks, you walks, she walks, they walks. And there are also more complex varieties where the use of S or no S is conditioned by something other than the person and number of the subject per se. So there are varieties which obey what's called the Northern subject rule, which is an alternation which is conditioned by whether the subject is a pronoun or not, among other things. So here we get strong verbs, we get some various forms of regularization, and again, you might think this is a good thing because it makes the language easier to learn, it makes the language simpler and more regular. But of course, these changes also are stigmatized. We also have verbs continuing to become weak. So this is something that we've seen every single week, is verbs becoming weak, but going from strong to weak. So we have the verb abide, to live. I abide near Constance. In the past tense, traditionally that would be I abode near Constance. In modern varieties, almost everyone would say I abided with a weak past tense with this dental preterite, this Germanic dental preterite. So abided rather than abode. So, and this is something that continues up until the present day. And there are some verbs that present day speakers really don't have intuitions about. So if you take the verb to stride, for instance, so striding is this. So that was a stride. The past tense, what did I just do? I strode, right? But what about the past participle? Most English people are very unhappy pronouncing any kind of past participle on this verb at all, because anything you do sounds wrong. I have strid, I have strud, stridden, strad, strud, I don't know. It's just completely, stridden is probably the best, but it still doesn't sound great. This is one of those verbs where we actually don't really know how to form the past participle at all. Fortunately, we don't have to talk about striding all that much, so we can usually get around the issue. But there you go. Okay, quick reminder, Old and Middle English had a subjunctive mood. This subjunctive mood was something that was used to express some kind of unreal situation, so a wish or a counterfactual, something that could happen, should happen, would happen, but didn't or might not happen, or might not have happened. And this is what the subjunctive in Old and Middle English are used for. It's not the same as the conjunctive in German, so do put that particular similarity out of your mind. It looks the same in some cases, but it doesn't work the same. So it has this irrealis meaning. Irrealis simply means unreal situation. So for instance, I want you to forget, you would say in Old English, ich will dat du vergita. And this is in the subjunctive, that is a subjunctive ending. Because if you want something, that means it hasn't happened yet. It might happen, but it's not a part of the real existing situation. So this is an irrealis use of the subjunctive. And Old English has a separate set of endings for the subjunctive for every single verb. It has very robust subjunctive endings. Now in modern English, the subjunctive doesn't have this anymore. And it's debatable whether we can even talk about English as having a subjunctive. Certainly, if what we mean by subjunctive is a separate set of forms, a separate paradigm, then English doesn't have it. English basically, insofar as it uses a subjunctive at all, it only uses bare infinitives in certain contexts, or in the other cases, different forms of the verb to be. So you do find something like, it is important that he leave, but this actually sounds very archaic and stilted to modern English speakers, and they would usually insert something like should here. So they would say, it's important that he should leave. So we usually get a modal used here rather than a subjunctive, even in the present day language. Or a to infinitive. So the Old English example, as you see, is the verb willen, which is like German wollen, and it can be followed with a finite clause, a that clause. In modern English, this is very marginal, and instead what you do is you have a to infinitive. So you say, I want you to forget. So these two infinitives also take over some of the domain of the subjunctive. It's important that he should leave. So these modals, these two infinitives, take over the domain of the subjunctive. And even if the subjunctive is used, it isn't a set of distinct forms. It's just forms that are used elsewhere in the language, like the bare infinitive form, that are sort of repurposed for the subjunctive. So it doesn't really make sense to talk about the present-day English language as having a subjunctive. Right, good. This is something that we picked up on last time. Then now we move on to the syntax. Auxiliaries. The number of auxiliaries and their use has increased since the early modern English period. So during this period, we see the emergence of strings of auxiliaries like the one here. He might have been being seen. And this is quite normal. In earlier stages of the language, you don't get quite as much use of these auxiliaries. You also get new modals, or what's called quasi-modals, being introduced during this period. You get something. You get these forms like gotte, gonna, hafte, and wanna. Krug 2000 has an overview of these forms and their emergence. They don't quite work the same way as normal modals. There are things that you can do with the normal modals in English that you can't do with these quasi-modals. You can't invert them, for instance. You can't ask a question by saying, have to you do that? Right? That's not possible. Or have you to do that also doesn't work. But these forms are nevertheless quite distinctive. So, for instance, have to, which means have, it means must, basically. It's an obligation, should or must. This is very distinctive because you can't pronounce it with a voiced fricative. So it's always have to, not have to. If you can't, you can't say something like, I have to do my homework. It's, I have to do my homework. So this is actually, it may look just like have and to, and no one ever writes it like I've written it on the slide, but that's how it is used, that's how it is pronounced. It's only the fact that the written language is conservative that means that these forms are not used. Likewise, gonna. Gonna is something that basically any speaker of English in the 20th century will use, and it has a future tense meaning. It has a very specific future tense meaning, actually. You can quite happily say, I'm going to do that tomorrow, meaning I will do that tomorrow. But the gonna cannot be used to replace going to in a motion context. So you can say, I am going to the shops, but not, I'm gonna the shops. So gonna is an auxiliary. It's a modal, quasi-modal auxiliary with this future tense meaning. We also get a new passive during this period. We get the get passive. And the get passive is something like this. He got knocked out. Now, this is first attested in 1562, so this is pre-Shakespeare, but it's getting more and more frequent. Now, what people often say about this is that it's an eventive passive. So it's used. It's often used in adversative contexts. I got stuck in traffic implies that it's bad, right? I got fired from work. It has these negative contexts. More generally, it's eventive for a lot of speakers. So people find themselves restricted to using it in these eventive contexts where it refers to a specific punctual happening. So getting stuck in traffic, getting fired is a single event. But you can also now use it in a stative context. So you can say something like, I got stuck in traffic for over an hour. Which means the same as, I was stuck in traffic for over an hour. Why is this important? Well, if you have this temporal modifier that adds a duration, this ought to be incompatible with eventive predicates. This ought to only work with statives. And if we have it here, that indicates that this is a state and that the get passive can be used with states and not just events. So this is a passive that's rising and rising in frequency. We can use it in all kinds of contexts now, and within 500 years, it has basically become the norm. What's interesting is that children in particular very, very heavily use this form. They will even repeat sentences back to adults with get in them, so if you where the adult hasn't used it. So if the adult says something like, the bread was eaten, the child will often say in response to that, yeah, the bread got eaten. So this is really, and usually when children start doing something like that, that's a good indication that it is the future of the language. Because ultimately what happens is that old people die of old age and children get old. And then they're the normal people. So always beware of that. Life goes on mercilessly. Here's another syntactic construction. You might not think of this as particularly striking, but it's actually something that we don't find in the history of the language until the 18th century. So the progressive passive, his tooth was being pulled out, where you have being plus a past participle. This is something that in earlier stages of the language, pre-18th century, you just couldn't do. So you would use the present participle, but you would use it in a rather weird way to our modern ears. You would say, his tooth was pulling out. And this is something that at the time was also very stigmatized. So during the 19th century, there were newspapers, and people would write letters to these newspapers saying, I wish all these young people would stop using the progressive passive. It's really ugly and uncouth. And again, you know, young people, so it becomes the future of the language. Today, this is completely unstigmatized. The progressive passive in the 21st century, no one would ever think to judge this. It's just something that everyone does, absolutely everyone. It's completely part of the standard language. No pedant would ever correct this. Interestingly, many of the early examples are from a particular group of poets and writers, including some quite famous ones like William Wordsworth. It's been suggested that these poets might have used this progressive passive as a linguistic identity marker to distinguish them from other more conservative writers of the period. So the progressive passive, if that's true, would have been progressive in more sense than one, because it would have been socially progressive as well as aspectually progressive. Relative clauses then. In relative clauses, we can use a few different relative pronouns. So you can say the book that I read, you can say the book which I read, you can say the book I read without a relative pronoun at all. Similarly with people, the person that I met, the person I met, the person who I met. And if you're really upper crust, you can say the person whom I met. But that's pretty much ungrammatical for even speakers like me. So that's a very archaic thing to say. Non-restrictive relatives work a bit differently. These are restrictive relatives because they restrict the set of reference. So the book that I read means of the set of all of the books, the relative clause picks out the one that I read. Non-restrictive relatives are different. They just add additional information about the reference. So Jane Austen, whose sentences were used above, we're not trying to restrict the set of things that are Jane Austen in this discourse because we know that there is only one Jane Austen. So we're just adding extra information about this person. So we're talking about restrictive relatives here. And the preference is to use that, particularly in speech. That is the normal form. But the prescriptive rules, so if you look at what prescriptivists say, you get who being used, not that or which. So when the head of the relative clause is a human, the person I met is supposed to be the person who I met or the person whom I met if you're being really prescriptivist, because it's a person. And the person that I met is disfavored by prescriptive grammarians. The other thing is that preposition stranding is also prescriptively disfavored, and you can only preposition strand with that. So you can say the book which I read about, you can say the book about which I read, you can say the book that I read about, but you can't say the book about that I read. That's ungrammatical. So the that form is very much sort of considered to be the lower ranking form as far as the official prescriptive rules are concerned. Nevertheless, in speech, this is the form that's used the majority of the time. And this seems to be independent of other factors to do with the noun. So here we've got results from a corpus. And a corpus is a collection of texts, simple as that. And corpora can be used for linguistic research. You can use it to actually check what do people actually do. And a lot of the research that's being done on languages today is corpus-based, because corpora simply give you a more representative idea than simply anecdotal information about what people are actually doing. Here we've got a corpus of spoken professional American, so this is quite a high register corpus as far as speech corpora are concerned, and what you see is that they use that over 80% of the time, and which is actually pretty rare in restrictive relatives. Another thing that we get emerging during this period is quotative like. Like starts out as a preposition, and it becomes a marker of reported speech or reported thought. So you can get things like, I'm like, blah, blah, blah. Here's the example is, I'm like, you know, I don't think so. She was like, ah. And that last example is really important because it doesn't embed finite clauses. It's not necessarily a marker of reported speech, because if you say, say something like, oh my God, I've got an exam tomorrow, and I'm like, ah. It doesn't mean that you're literally going around constantly going, ah. What it means is it represents that your mental state is somewhat below the usual happy norm, right? So this is actually really reportative of mental state or of a state in general, rather than being a marker of reported speech per se. But you can use it for both. Now, this is extremely prescriptively frowned upon. So this is something that you find, actually, it emerges during the 20th century. It's prescriptively frowned upon, but again, it's very widespread. So this is something that I will do. I probably won't do it very much in a lecture context, though I might do it a bit. I should go back and listen to the videos and see if I actually do. I probably do. Anyway, it's prescriptively frowned upon. It's associated with young people, which again means that it's probably the future, right? And it's also used as a discourse marker. So sometimes you can just insert like as a kind of pause filler. You can use it to emphasize something. The actual functions of like are quite difficult to pin down. What you do find is that it's very, very widely used. And if you go to Britain or America and talk to young people, this is one of the sort of the number one features that doesn't get taught in traditional English lessons that you will encounter in your everyday usage. And Tagliamonti, in her 2016 book, Teen Talk, gives a great overview of some of these features that are basically the future of the English language. And I did an interview with her, which is an audio interview that you can listen to if you want to find out more about this. Particularly focused on her experience, which is with Canadian teenagers, but teenagers as a whole are actually surprisingly homogeneous across Britain, America, and Canada. A lot of them are doing the same things, and like is one of them. So this represents what I was just saying. All right, we will now move on to lexical features. Now, the lexicon, of course, is always changing. So here is a list. This is a really not very exciting and extremely random list of words that appear in various fields during this period. Some of these words obviously are words for new things, so you don't need a word for radiotherapy unless you live in a society that has radiotherapy, for instance. You don't need a word for atom bombs unless you live in a society that has atom bombs, or at least can conceive of having atom bombs. And obviously you don't need a word for Freudian unless you live in a society that knows what or who Sigmund Freud is. So all of these things, you simply get new words because you have new things. And from a linguistic perspective, that's one of the less interesting things we can observe. Some of these, actually, I'm not really sure what they mean. I have no idea what a soupy is, for instance. Presumably it's something that's like soup, but not soup? I don't know. But there are various words that emerge during this period. That's the moral of the story here. You don't have to memorize all of them. Now, where do words come from in the modern period? Well, they come from pretty much the same places they've always come from. And this includes sources like compounding, which are less productive now than they were in the Old English period, but are still quite widely found. So, for instance, acid rain is a new compound. And that one is quite a literal compound because it is rain that has acid in it. So there's no that has a what's called a clearly compositional meaning. If you know what acid is and you know what rain is, then you know what acid rain is. On the other hand, you have compounds that are non-transparent in their meaning, like glass ceiling. So if you know what glass is and you know what a ceiling is, you won't necessarily know what this word means, which refers to a hypothetical barrier that prevents women from advancing in certain fields or disciplines. So that's the glass ceiling. You also get new loan words. So we have Angst, which comes in from Germany. It doesn't mean fear. It has a more specific meaning, a special kind of fear or anxiety. You get words like jungle and broccoli, new derived terms. So if you have a word like modern, you can use the prefix post and you can form postmodern. We have clippings and merges. So decaf is a clipping. So this is a decaffeinated drink. You can just take the second part of the word off. A motel comes from the word motor and hotel when you put the two together. Brexit, one of my least favorite words, comes from Britain and exit put together, and various other things. So slang isn't really an origin for words, but words can enter the mainstream based on their original usage in other in particular slang fields. And acronyms and abbreviations become mainstream. So SUV and ATM, these are things that are pronounced with each of the letters separately. You also get acronyms like LOL, which if you pronounce it is pronounced LOL and only very rarely LOL. These are, again, various ways in which the modern language forms new words. So here are some very new words. These are the OED. Every month the OED adds some new words. They're not always new words. They're just words that the OED decides needs to be added in. So one of these words is the Bechdel test. If you don't know what this is a very nice test to see whether a movie meets basic feminist standards. If a movie passes the best Bechdel test, it has to have at least two women in it, and they have to have a conversation at some point during the movie, and that conversation has to be about something other than a man. And it's really quite amazing just how many mainstream movies continue to fail this basic test. But anyway, that's the Bechdel test. Imposter syndrome, not a new idea. So imposter syndrome is something that if you get someone like me, how old am I even? I'm 33 years old, I'm a professor, and I'm like, what the hell? Surely, sometime soon, someone is going to figure out that I'm actually a massive fraud, and that I've basically bullshitted my way into academia. And that's imposter syndrome. Lorem ipsum, I don't know if you're familiar with this one. Lorem ipsum is when you have a newspaper or a magazine, or you want to just put some filler text in there to see what the text will look like. It often has this pseudo-Latin, lorem ipsum dolor sit amet. And this is often called lorem ipsum text now. So it's a word in its own right. Precariat, this is an interesting term. It's a particular class. It's people who are basically living hand-to-mouth. So people with short-term contracts, with short-term rent, who don't have a long-term perspective on their future, as distinct from, a traditional working class. And finally, the term spoiler alert, which is amply illustrated here. I've moved quite briefly over the lexicon section because all that can really be said in very general terms is that English gets a lot of new words during this period, and it will continue to do so. And it's always worth keeping an eye out for what the OED considers to be worthy of inclusion. Now we're going to talk a bit about varieties and attitudes to the English language. And this, of course, is something that we've been unable to avoid talking about throughout the rest of the lecture, because these recent changes are mostly recent enough to have left an impact on the language as it is spoken today, and on how people think about the language today, more importantly. So first of all, we talked a little bit about dictionaries last time. We also see during the 18th century and beyond the emergence of grammars. So people describing not just what words are in the language, but also the structure of the language. So Samuel Johnson, who you can see up at the top there, he has a grammar in his dictionary. Now, Johnson is mostly not very prescriptive. He mostly remains fairly non-judgmental, but he can be judgmental. So, for instance, the word to profound, which is a very strange verb in the sense to me that I don't know who uses this word. Johnson apparently knew some people who used it, but he didn't like them very much because he calls it a barbarous word. Then you get Louth. Now, Robert Louth is a very interesting man. He's the one, the skinny one in the middle. Johnson, you can recognise in pictures because he's been putting on the pounds a little bit. I think he spent too much time writing dictionaries and not enough time on the treadmill, though I'm a fine one to talk, in fairness. So Louth became Bishop of London, but before he did that, he wrote a short introduction to English grammar. And this is prescriptive in a sense, but it's only prescriptive in a certain sense, because what Louth is doing when he writes this grammar, and he says, look, if you want to get ahead in the world, this is what you ought to do. He's not saying everyone ought to talk like this, everyone ought to use English this same way. He's just saying, this is what the high-class people do, and if you want to be like them, that's what you should do as well. So that's Louth. It's often been overstated exactly how prescriptive he was. He's often seen as the real bad guy. But if you read, there's a book about him by Ingrid Tiken, and this book kind of dispels some of the myths surrounding Louth. He wasn't quite as much of a bad guy as we thought he was. Lindley Murray, on the other hand, he's a bad guy, because for a start, he just takes Louth's grammar and mercilessly plagiarizes it. And not only that, he was hugely successful and influential with his plagiarism. He's also much more prescriptive. So a lot of the things Louth says, well, if you want to adopt the high register, you should use this form. Murray usually trims it down a bit. He just says, you should use this form, period. Right? That's all there is to it. Everyone should use these same forms. So Murray is really, he's one of the sort of the founding fathers of prescriptivism. And but it's hard, again, it's hard to overstate his influence on the field and through him Louth's influence, because he's plagiarizing Louth. And here's him down here. As for dictionaries, what we saw in the earlier stages were lists of hard words. So you saw lists of words that are difficult for people to pronounce or which people don't know. In 1702, you get Kersey's New English Dictionary, and this is a modern dictionary with real definitions. It's not just a list of words. There's 28,000 words in it, so it's not huge, but it is still a useful resource. But some of his definitions are not enormously useful. For instance, in Kersey's dictionary, a goat is simply defined as a beast. If you don't know what a goat is, this will not help you. I mean, I guess it narrows it down a bit, but still. 1721, Nathan Bailey, he also likes to have a big grand name for his dictionary, the Universal Etymological English Dictionary, which is 40,000 words, and 30 years later we get the most famous dictionary, which is Samuel Johnson's dictionary, which is also 40,000 words. And what Johnson does that previous dictionary writers didn't do, the people who make dictionaries are called lexicographers. That's the word I was looking for, lexicographers. Johnson is the first lexicographer to include examples from actual usage. So he's using real data in his dictionary. Johnson also is sometimes, he has some rather strange things in his dictionary. Patron, for instance, he defines this as commonly a wretch who supports with insolence and is paid with flattery. Now, the main thing that you can infer from this definition is that Johnson himself did not like his patron very much. Johnson's patron, Lord Chesterfield, was not always seen as a very supportive man. This he's now been immortalized in history because he was not a very good patron. Of course, we still have prescriptivism. Prescriptivism is alive and well today. In the US, people like Edwin Newman and William Safire are very, very influential in policing the usage of the modern American language. In the UK, we have a similar bunch of these guys, people like Lynn Truss, John Humphreys, who's quite a famous broadcaster, Neville Gwynn, who one famous linguist recently described as a preposterous old fraud. These people are very influential because there is a real market for people buying these books because they think that language is something which has a right or a wrong answer to it, and they think that by reading these people, they will somehow become better human beings of more self-worth. Now, of course, it should go without saying by now that as theoretical linguists, we are descriptivists, right? We are, and everything you will be taught on this course is descriptive linguistics. We want to understand how the language works. We don't want particularly to tell people what they ought to be doing. Now, obviously, a lot of you will become teachers of English, and you have a choice what to do here, because, of course, you will have to tell people how to use the language. That's your job. But you don't have to tell them to use ridiculous, archaic things of the kind that prescriptivists often do. So, for instance, split infinitives, stranded prepositions. These are things that people are often judged by prescriptivists for doing. In fact, there's no reason not to do them. There's nothing wrong with them linguistically. There's nothing that's less logical, less elegant. All of this stuff is just the opinions of a few old people. So you should be obviously careful about how serious you take it. What is important, of course, is that you will want your students to do as well in life as they can. And that does involve teaching them a standard variety, or at least as part of what you teach them how varieties are perceived, how varieties are judged. So these are really the options that are available to you. If you're going to teach people, let's say, standard British English, then it's a good idea to make them aware, to make the students aware that this is not the only variety, and that it's not, in any absolute sense, the best variety. It might be the most prestigious, but that doesn't give it inherently any more value than any other. Regardless of what you do, I think it's important to acknowledge that, first of all, prescriptivism is important in the world that we live in, even though it really shouldn't be, because most of it is based on nonsense. And that is the second point. Most prescriptivism is very, very badly informed. It's not a coincidence, and it's never been a coincidence, that the languages, the varieties that are the most prestigious, are the varieties of the people who have the power and the people who have the privilege. And that is really, in a nutshell, what we're dealing with here. Much of the time, when people judge other people for the language that they're using, they're using it as a proxy. They're using it because they want to judge someone for the race that they belong to, for the gender that they identify as, for the class that they come from, and because it's politically incorrect to do those things, they use language instead. So a lot of prescriptivism is not just wrong and badly informed, it's also deeply offensive and basically toxic. Prescriptivism, it's up to you how you deal with it, but I would encourage you to take an open mind. All right, as far as the English dialects are concerned nowadays, we're not going to dwell on this, partly because we don't have time, but partly because this is a history course, not a dialects course. If you take a course in sociolinguistics or varieties of English, you'll find out more about these present-day varieties. But for now, we can just say, when we divide up England, we divide it up into basically two major regions, the north and the south. And this is not just a linguistic divide, it's also a major sociological and political divide. And it's reflected in, for instance, novels like Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South, which is a 19th century novel. Very good book, worth having a look at. She's not as famous as people like Dickens or Austen, but in my view, she should be. You can divide up these varieties more closely if you want. So you can say there's a southwestern variety, an eastern variety. You can talk about the west central, east central, lower north, and northeast as being separate dialects. Of course, these lines are abstractions. You don't suddenly get a different form when you cross the line. And rather, these different forms shade into each other. It's more of a continuum. But some of the most salient features that you will see today that differentiate English dialects from each other are things like long ah versus short ah, in words like bath, which in the north would be pronounced bath, grass would be pronounced grass, and so on. Also in the south, you get ah in words like up, but, and duck. In the north, you get up, but, and duck. And these are very salient features of Northern English. These vowels are probably the things that people pick out the most as being characteristic of Southern or Northern England. But they're not the only thing. There are many, many variants. And again, take a look at this website if you want to find out a bit more about the different dialects of English and the features that they have. There are some beautiful maps on there which show how these features are distributed. Now, before we finish, just one more thing, and although I'm not going to give it much time, it's probably, in a way, the most important fact that we will cover, because it's about how English got all around the world. You can see on the map, this is something that is a tremendous development, which mostly happened during the period that we're interested in. First, certainly from 1600 onwards, as part of British colonialism. So we get from 1607, we get British settlements in North America. A little bit later on, we find people have got to India. British people have established outposts, trading outposts in India from 1612. And then later they get to other places. They move, you get British people showing up in the Caribbean. You get them showing up in West Africa. Later, also Australia, South Africa, New Zealand. These people got everywhere, and they left their language wherever they went. And so this is why English is so widespread, because English people went a lot of places, and there's, of course, a certain amount of luck involved. If the population mix had been somewhat different, because, of course, not all of the North Americans came from England or even Britain, a lot of them came from Germany, a lot of them came from places like Spain as well. So it's really hard to think exactly why English, of all languages, took over, but the fact remains that it did. When we talk about the different languages of the different varieties of English that exist around the world, these are often called world Englishes, which is a somewhat awkward term. All Englishes are world Englishes, because at least none of them are spoken in space, or at least not very much, because there aren't many people in space. All right, so this circle model has been criticized, but this basically gives you an idea of the relations of the different variants of English to each other. So in the inner circle, we've got the places where English is spoken as a mother tongue, and where it's always been spoken as a mother tongue, essentially, from the first settlement. So UK, US, Australia, New Zealand, also Ireland, from the very earliest days. So this is the first diaspora. The places where in the 17th century and the early 18th century, English was already spread. So the Caribbean, where English is spoken, also Anglophone Canada and South Africa. And what's important about these inner circle regions is really that they provide the norm for all of the other regions. These inner circle regions, the other varieties look to them as providing the norm for them to base their own language usage on, or at least historically that has been the case. Nowadays, it's becoming more normal for countries to develop their own norm and their own standards for speaking English. So in the outer circle, for instance, which contains many countries in Asia and Africa, this is the second diaspora. India in particular, India and Pakistan are important in this context. And in these countries, they can be distinguished from what's called the expanding circle, because in these countries, these are essentially countries that have at least been affected by British colonialism. Pretty much everywhere else in the world can be considered the expanding circle. So we're in the expanding circle right now, because I'm here speaking English and you're all understanding what I say, or at least some of it. This is the expanding circle. The expanding circle is basically everywhere else in the world where English is spoken, and that really is pretty much everywhere now. But places where there's no history of colonization and no history of English playing a historical or governmental role. So that's what distinguishes the outer circle from the expanding circle. Like I say, this model has been criticized, but because it's very influential and it gives you at least a historical perspective on the spread of the language, I've chosen to briefly present it here. Again, if you do a course on varieties of English, you might find out more. So, American English, there are a few historical details here. For time reasons, I won't go into this, but we can basically break this up into three periods. Firstly, the colonial period, where we see the first colonies founded in 1607, and then in 1776, the big historical event we talked about at the start, the US Declaration of Independence. So during this period, over 150 years, the US is a colony of Britain. And it develops its own variety during this period because of its distance from Britain, but they are still very much during this time looking to the motherland for linguistic guidance. This is, we speak their language, basically. During the national period, that's when we get things like Webster's Dictionary emerging and a consciousness, we're speaking our language now. American English is a thing. We are America, we speak American English. So we get this self-awareness. And then from 1898 onwards, so basically the 20th century and beyond, American English expands. And now, if there is really a world language, it's not British English so much as it is American English that is the default language of academia, of trade, of the economy, and of politics. And that is the result of this international period with American English spreading into other areas of the world. Okay, so as usual, you can perfectly well read the summary in your own time. What I would like you to do is two things. First of all, take a look at this website and have a glance at the maps and these dialect features of English. Look at where they're used and just have a browse. Secondly, there is a text. This text, here your task is somewhat different from your usual task, because usually your task is to understand the text. Here you will have no problem understanding the text, but what I want you to do is try and pick out the differences. Try and spot where this text differs from what you might consider to be the modern, present-day English norm. That is it for today. Next week we will be doing an overview and revision session, and I will see you then.